From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And this week, it's natural, it's exciting, but it can also be dangerous. It's sex.
I'm not going to say he made me a woman. He took my virginity. That's what he did.
A story about young love, the choices we make, and how choice can be taken away forever. And then the Texas battle over reproductive rights.
We always, it's the kids first. It's my family first. And then if we have enough money left over, then maybe I can go get a pap smear.
Poverty and sexual health in the Rio Grande Valley. And our new series, The Dearly Deported, stories from los deportados around the world. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And this week, it's all about those three little letters that can make life both complicated and exciting. S-E-X. On our show today, some delicate issues. So, queridos, be advised. For women of color and immigrants, sexual abuse and the pressure to stay quiet has been an unfortunate part of our country's history. More recently, the discussion around sexual and reproductive rights has focused on a woman's right to privacy, to have an abortion. But in our first story, Caitlin Prest brings us a different take on choice.
I would have been a phenomenal mother.
The curiosity about love set me on this path, man. That shit is no joke. No joke.
This is Maria de Jesus, also known as T.S.
Tough shit.
She insisted everyone call her T.S., even her mom.
I substituted it for a lot of things, too sweet, whatever.
Maria's mother still calls her T.S. to this day, with reason. She was always a bit wild.
I was curious about life.
And life had a lot of excitement to offer where she grew up. She lived in Los Sures, which is what they called the south side of Williamsburg, New York, when it was Puerto Rican families that lived there. It was the 70s, and Maria's mother had a lot on her plate. She had four kids. She was doing it all on her own. Her first husband turned out to be extremely abusive, and when she left him, she needed to go on welfare to keep the family afloat. Maria was the first daughter.
When a young girl loves, oh my gosh, she loves for real. You know, it's not no lie. I wanted to know what this is really all about. The pools will open up late. And I met him there. He was a lifeguard. And he was teaching me how to swim. They were all interested in him. It made me feel like very important. You know what I mean?
This guy was also 24, college grad. She says he was a physical therapist. Maria followed him wherever he went.
I just wanted to breathe this man, you know? Like, I didn't know how I wasn't gonna be able not to. He got me, like, to go to his mom's house, you know? And they weren't in town, I think, and he took me. They lived in the Bronx. So I'm on a mission with this guy out there. I had no idea, like, what was awaiting me, but I'm not going to say he made me a woman. He took my virginity. That's what he did.
I think my mom had found out or something like that, like, because somebody saying, you know, I seen your daughter, she looks pregnant, or I was just walking around and I was like, yeah, I kind of think I am, but I wasn't sure, you know, I was young.
And when I called him to tell him that I was pregnant,
He denied that it was his. And I said, you know, you're the only one. This is your baby. But I wouldn't want you to be a father to my child.
I didn't want to repeat the same thing and be a single parent. I saw the struggle of that. You know, so I didn't go that way. I just didn't.
So I had this GYN here on Broadway that, you know, I was going to. And I guess they set it up, you know, to have the abortion. And the day that I went, it was sad. I had no idea of, like, you know, at that age, emotionally, you don't understand the impact of the choices you make. You know, I remember the nurse coming to me and telling me, yeah, this is what you get for having sex at an early age. This is how you pay for it. And my mom telling me, no, don't do it, you know, but it was too late. You know, I'm already in bed with a f***ing IV in my arm. You know, I remember coming out of it, cramping. And, you know, you're asleep while you're going through it. So what the fuck, you know what they're doing. You have no idea of what the procedure even entails. I wasn't able to ever conceive after that. The doctor, I believe that she botched me, because later on in life, my mom brought me an infertility book. I think that she was just like one of those people that clearly, like, 15-year-old girls shouldn't be f***ing, you know? And I understand that. But who are you to judge? I would have been a phenomenal mother. And that chance was, like, literally, like, taken away from me, you know?
Maria believes that on that day, the doctor intentionally rendered her unable to have children. But she never sought proof. Her subsequent infertility could have been an accident. But Maria feels certain that it wasn't. She had heard stories from her peers about women being sterilized, with or without their knowledge.
I remember hearing stories, or, you know, like in Puerto Rico or something. I remember here in New York too. That the doctors, that they were like practicing all these like birth control methods, you know, on the woman surgically and bullshitting them.
Before birth control, abortion, and sterilization methods were available to the public, they were used by the state. Doctors in the 20s used them when eugenics was the latest way to improve society. Eugenics was about controlling genetics as a method of social change. Many U.S. states had laws mandating doctors to sterilize women who might give birth to undesirable children. Women who were physically or cognitively disabled, unmarried women, and poor women were some of the targeted demographics. Views about race got mixed up in there as well. Dorothy Roberts is an academic studying race and the law.
Well, I've written three main books.
In her book,
Killing the Black Body, Race, Reproduction, and the Meaning of Liberty,
she looks at the history of eugenics, family planning, and reproductive control in the United States. The practices used in the eugenics era fell out of favor after World War II, but they didn't disappear. Some of the compulsory sterilization laws were still on the books.
Because of the view by doctors that women of color, especially if they were welfare recipients, shouldn't be having children, they would sterilize them, you know, coercively, either, for example, tell them if they didn't consent to sterilization, they'd lose their welfare benefits, or they wouldn't receive reproductive health services like abortion services if they didn't consent to sterilization.
Sunflower County, Mississippi, 1961. Fannie Lou Harmer goes in to have a small uterine tumor removed. She comes out with a full hysterectomy, without her consent or even her knowledge. Mrs. Ralph in Alabama believes she's being asked to sign a form for Depo-Provera injections for her two daughters, Minnie Lee and Mary Alice. Unable to read English, she simply signs her form with an X. Both of her daughters, ages 12 and 14, are sterilized. Boston City Hospital. A teenage girl, 12 weeks pregnant, arrives to get an abortion, told it is too late and that a hysterectomy is necessary. A medical student asks the doctor about the extreme diagnosis. The doctor tells him it was for the experience. These cases are only a few of thousands.
There's a history of the view that social problems are caused by the wrong people having children, and that the government can therefore come in and keep them forcibly from having children through sterilization.
There were few legal policies regulating doctors' choices in these matters. On the contrary, legal precedent was in support of these practices.
Doctors who, I'm not a psychologist, but I think they may have convinced themselves that they're doing good for society and for these women themselves.
Legal action was eventually taken. The laws were changed after a class action suit in 1974. Federal District Court Judge Gerard Jessel estimated that 100,000 to 150,000 low-income women and women of color had been sterilized under federal programs. Jessel outlawed the use of federal dollars for involuntary sterilization, and the lawsuit's exposure led to the requirement that doctors obtain informed consent before performing sterilization procedures.
We're talking about the 1970s and 80s. It's not ancient history. People seem to think, you know, it's all over with, but it isn't. It just, you know, it moves from one group of women to another.
According to the Center for Investigative Reporting, doctors under contract with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation sterilized nearly 150 female inmates from 2006 to 2010 without required state approvals. The argument for these practices is still about whether these women are considered fit to have children. Whether or not the decision about lifelong fertility should be in the hands of the state is a question that remains to be answered. Maria, for one, is very skeptical. For Latina USA, I'm Caitlin Prest.
This crazy love.
If that story left you reeling and you want to read more about women and the history of sterilization, go to our website, latinousa.org. Our piece was originally produced for the Audio Smut podcast by Caitlin Prest and Mitra Kaboli, with help from Julia Alsop. And now, mis queridos radio escuchas, I want to take a minute to let you know about an exciting upcoming event. Monday, December 9th at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, I'll be with you on Reddit, where you can ask me anything. Just go to the AMA page on Reddit. I want to talk with you about all the latest news about reproductive rights, immigration reform or lack thereof, the Fast for All hunger strikers, democracy, and a lot more. So join me on Reddit.com Monday, December 9th at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And coming up on Latino USA, hard choices about health, even where to get medication.
Between themselves, they would say, I have a friend that can get some from Mexico, or they sell some at the flea market.
How budget cuts are affecting Latina health in South Texas. No se vayan. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today we're talking about sex, which can be a difficult topic for all kinds of reasons. But when you're a Latino woman, well, it can get complicated for all kinds of other reasons. Writer Erica Sanchez spends a lot of her time thinking, talking, and writing about sex. She's a poet and sex advice columnist for Cosmo for Latinas. And Erica Sanchez joins us to talk on Latino USA. Welcome to our program, Erica.
Thank you.
You have written a lot about the issue of the disjuncture between Latinas being portrayed on the one hand like virgins, like very family oriented, like all about our kids, and at the same time being presented as the voluptuous, the Sofia Vergara, the we are hot Latina women. How do you resolve these two parts of who we as Latinas are portrayed as?
That's a great question. I think that I'm constantly trying to resolve that. It's actually not something that I even thought about until a few years ago when I realized that through all of the writing that I was doing that there's such a contradiction between cultural expectations of being a pious, obedient daughter, and then also having these images of the hypersexualized Latina in our culture, in mainstream American culture. And so I like to consider myself a very liberated woman who owns her sexuality and all of that. But it took so much work to get there. It's not easy. It took a lot of unpacking a lot of my cultural baggage, just kind of understanding my childhood, where my mother was coming from growing up. Sex was something that was done to you if you were a girl. And I always had that in my head, like sex was this like terrible act.
And it does feel when we as Latinas are working through it, that you are completely alone.
Yes, because if you're sexual, then you're, you know, a slut. I could think of a million words in Spanish that you could be called. I think that's really unfortunate. That creates so much anxiety, so many hangups for a lot of second generation women like me. And through my sex column and my sex writing, I try to navigate that and try to like help other women like me understand all of those different implications.
We also have this sense of conventional wisdom. It's not a great term. The conventional wisdom is, well, issues with birth control. They come from, you know, predominantly Catholic countries. So is it true?
I think a lot of that is not actually true. And there have been studies that show that most Latinos are in favor of a woman's choice when it comes to abortion. There's also this idea that we're conservative. You know, that's not really the case. And 1 in 3 women have an abortion. A lot of them are Latina. What's really unfortunate is that there are so many women doing amazing work, many Latinas. But that doesn't really get covered. The mainstream feminist media is very white. There are so many women of color fighting for their rights. They don't get the credit that they deserve.
Where does feminism come into the conversation around Latinas vis-a-vis their sexuality?
And I write about the body all the time. And that's kind of like my writerly obsession. We grow up being told what to do with our bodies. Don't dress a certain way. Don't be sexual. That's on the Mexican traditional side. And then American media really encourages women to be sexual as well. But if you're sexual, you're promiscuous. And if you're promiscuous, you're a bad person, you know? And so there's just so many messages that are conflicting and confusing. For me, being a feminist is being in charge of my own body and encouraging other women to be in charge of their own bodies and, you know, protecting those rights. And I didn't grow up in a place where feminism was encouraged. In fact, I mean, I became like a lone feminist when I was like 12. No one really knew what the hell I was talking about.
So you came home one day and you in Cicero,
yeah.
Very south in Chicago, and you came home one day and you said, "Mami, papi, quiero ser feminista."
Yeah, I mean, they thought I was crazy. And I, you know, like Thanksgiving, all the women are cooking and then the men get to eat first. And I would point that out and everyone thought I was nuts. Like everyone wanted me to shut up. And I guess I was annoying, I'll admit. I was like a little Lisa Simpson. And it was tough because no one really was on board with what I was trying to communicate.
Do you find now in your writing and in your work with Latinas that there is an openness or a hesitance around being a feminista?
I think a lot of people have a misconception of what being a feminist is, and I find that really unfortunate. I've heard a lot of really negative things about feminists just from everybody, not just Latinas, And to me, being a feminist is considering women to be human beings. You know, it's very basic. We have the same rights. I don't see why that's even so radical, to be quite honest. Maybe there is a hesitancy because it's a realm that has excluded us for so long. I try to own it. I feel like this is, it's our right to be part of the conversation. I wish that publications would allow more women of color to write and to tell our stories.
What would you like to see your daughter when she's growing up? What would you like the messages about what it is to be a young Latina American in a kind of holistic way?
That's a great question. And I think about that a lot because I do want to have children at some point. And I worry about what it would be like to have a daughter because there's so many different messages that we're bombarded with. I would like her just to be her own person without feeling the need to, you know, be hypersexual, quote unquote, or be docile. I mean, I just want her to see great examples of other women. And there are so many wonderful women doing wonderful work, and they're just not on TV. They're not on the radio. I mean, you're doing great work, which is fantastic, but, you know, there's not enough. I wish that were a common image. It's our responsibility to create that world.
Would you say, Erica, that you consider yourself to be a fearless woman?
No, I'm constantly scared, I'll say. But despite being scared, I just kind of put myself out there. And I'd like to say that I'm fearless, but that's not true. I think I just, despite my fear, I do it anyway.
Erica Sanchez, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you.
Speaking with us in the Chicago studios of WBEZ, that was Erica Sanchez, journalist, poet, and sex columnist with Cosmo for Latinas. And now on to Texas, where a controversial new state law limiting abortions made headlines around the country, as did a marathon filibuster by Democratic State Senator Wendy Davis that temporarily blocked its passage.
Senator Wendy Davis started talking about 1118 this morning. She is essentially talking the bill to death.
Coming up, a perspective on the issue from a Texas Republican and a Democrat. But first, we want to hear how those reproductive health policies are affecting Texans, especially in Latino communities. One of the poorest areas of our country, historically, is the Rio Grande Valley.
Funding for women's health has been cut.
The women there depended on health care and family planning services given by state-funded clinics. But after severe funding cuts in 2011, the number of women getting treatment dropped sharply. Only about a quarter as many women received services in the last year.
Well, in 2011, two-thirds of the family planning program was cut.
That's Jessica Gonzalez Rojas, the executive director of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Rights. The cuts in Texas were part of an effort by Republican-held state legislatures around the country to defund Planned Parenthood clinics.
It was really an effort to curb women's reproductive health access and access to family planning services such as contraception and pap smears.
After the cuts, Paula Saldaño lost her job as a promotora, or community educator, for a Planned Parenthood clinic in Brownsville, Texas. Now she continues to give workshops on reproductive health as a volunteer and says that the women she counsels have become desperate for screenings and medications.
Between themselves, they would say, I have a friend that can get some from Mexico, or they sell some at the flea market. And of course, I would try to tell them, you know, you really do need for it to be prescribed and it needs to be under the care of a doctor. But they would turn around and they were right. Where would they go now? Where do we go that is not going to charge me $500 or $600 for a cheap biopsy?
She knows from her own experience that there is nowhere she can send them. This past spring, the Republican-majority Texas legislature reinstated some of the family planning budget. But it's uncertain whether the money restored will be enough to repair the damage done to the state's reproductive health system. We spoke with two Texas lawmakers about the issues. If you've been watching the news, then you've probably heard this voice before.
Mr. President, parliamentary inquiry. At what point
Must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
That's Leticia Vandeput. She's the Texas state senator who stood with Senator Wendy Davis during that 11-hour filibuster to block SB 5, legislation that would eventually pass to create new abortion regulations in Texas. Last week, Vandeput declared she'll be seeking the Democratic nomination for lieutenant governor next year, and she joins us now on Latino USA from the studios of KSTX in San Antonio, Texas. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you so much for having me on today.
So the fight over reproductive health is really much bigger than just the Texas abortion law. In fact, the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health just released a detailed report about the effects of the 2011 family planning cuts in Texas on women, specifically in the Rio Grande Valley. So, Senator, what exactly does reproductive rights and access look like for Latinas in Texas now?
It's heartbreaking. It is a shame. 35% of women of reproductive age in Texas are uninsured. So in areas of the Rio Grande, we know that 9 of our 32 clinics that offered any sort of reproductive health services were forced to close because of the cuts of 2011. Women will die because they're not going to get a pap smear or a mammogram. It's heartbreaking.
If you end up being elected as the lieutenant governor, what would you do in terms of changing policy and impacting Latinas and their access to reproductive health?
Well, the first thing would be education. And understand that when we talk about Latina healthcare, some of the first things cut in the school budgets were things like the teen pregnancy programs. For Latina health, wouldn't it be a great perspective that you understand that women are the health deciders in their family, right? And particularly Latinas, it's always customary. I call it the burnt tortilla syndrome. You know, who is the one that always gets the little tortilla that has the burnt or the cut or the, right? It's mommy, right?
I've actually never heard that, and actually being the one that likes the burnt tortillas, but
I do
you're
too,
right.
But I think I like it because I know, esto está muy tostadito, you know? This one's too much, so we'll eat it, right? Because it's not going to go to waste. But we always, it's the kids first. It's my family first. And then if we have enough money left over, then maybe I can go get a pap smear. Maybe I can go get a mammogram. Maybe I can do that. What we need to make sure is that we don't put barriers to their healthcare access, because we know that when women are able to access that family planning services, that they're able to plan their pregnancy and plan their families. And these unintended pregnancy, I mean, we pay for them through our Medicaid program. So it seems to me that it would be very cost effective to our state if we would just make sure that women had the access to the reproductive services that they so desperately need. I think we've done about as all damage as we can. I mean, to the Republicans, they were out to get Planned Parenthood. They've done a really good job. It's the collateral damage that they've inflicted while achieving this objective that is horrendous for Latinas.
Senator Leticia Vandeput, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Gracias, Maria.
Leticia Vandeput is seeking the Democratic nomination for Lieutenant Governor of Texas. She spoke to us from the studios of KSTX in San Antonio, Texas. While Senator Vandeput was standing with Wendy Davis against the new abortion legislation, another Latino Texas lawmaker made a passionate speech in favor of the law.
I stand with Texas women, but I shall stand here no longer and be accused of conducting a war on women, or that my intentions are not wholly honorable merely because I choose to protect and support human life.
That representative is Jason Villalba, a freshman Republican who's been called by some local media the future of the Texas GOP. Republican Representative Jason Villalba joins us now from his office in Dallas. Welcome to Latino USA, Representative.
Thank you so much, Maria. It's wonderful to hear from you today.
So in that speech we just heard a clip from, you said that you took offense at the idea that Texas Republicans were waging a war on women. So
Why do you say Texas is not waging a war on women?
The attacks that were coming against Republicans were on this focus of what they called a war on women. But I said, look, take a look at the Republican perspective. We don't do this as an attack on women's reproductive rights. We do this because we believe that we are in a battle to protect the most vulnerable in our society, the unborn.
Can you clarify for us exactly what is your position on abortion and why it is so important to you?
For most of my life, I've been what they call a pro-lifer in name only until I had my own child. We were fortunate enough to get some very early sonograms, and I saw my baby for the very first time. And if you look at a 12-week gestated baby, it's very small, but it's got fingers and it's got eyes and it can move and it can look at you, all these different things. And I said, look, this is something that's human. This is a human being. We have a duty to protect human beings if they're outside of the womb. And so I think we also have a duty as elected officials to protect babies inside the womb.
So one of the issues that we're covering on our show today deals with the Texas family planning budget, which was dramatically cut in 2011. At the time, you were not a Texas state representative, but it was a Republican-led effort to defund those clinics. So what would your position be if the issue came up again now, and why?
So the option that we gave the clinics was, you can either abandon your relationship with Planned Parenthood and establish your own clinic, or we're going to be forced to defund you because we've already made this decision in a previous legislature under previous law that we are prohibited from funding those clinics that have Planned Parenthood resources. So that's what happened. Regardless of what the law is, we do have a situation and a growing problem where Latinas and all women are struggling to have access to health care. So I think we have a real duty in the state of Texas to begin to explore ways to do that. We did put some money back into some clinics that were able to provide health care services for women. So that's a first step. It's not enough, but it's something that shows that we are in good faith endeavoring to do what we know our job is, and that is to make sure that our citizens have adequate health care in the face of being disadvantaged.
So you've heard it before, the statement made by then President Ronald Reagan that Latinos are Republicans, they just don't know it yet. What do you think about in terms of the relationship between Latinos and the Republican Party?
I do believe that Hispanics are a conservative people. Now, I will say that the Republican Party has historically done a poor job of engaging the Hispanic community in a meaningful and sensitive way. We are the party that believes in lower taxes and lower regulations for small business. Many Hispanics own small businesses. We are the party that protects human life and is willing to vote in favor of the culture of life. And many Hispanics are from a Catholic background, so that's important. So I think we do well on those issues.
Representative Villalba, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Maria, for having me, and please don't hesitate to reach out to me again.
Jason Villalba is a Republican representative in the Texas State Legislature. He spoke to us from his offices in Dallas. And if you want to hear more about why Senator Vandeput thinks Latinas will change Texas politics forever, check out her extended interview on our SoundCloud. And coming up on Latino USA, sometime soon, the Obama administration will reach the 2 million mark for the number of deportations during his administration.
She said, what are you doing in our country? I said, I am studying. She said, no, you're not. What are you doing here?
Stories we call the dearly deported. Coming up on Latino USA, no se vayan.
Todo lo que hay mucho más. Por favor.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And this week, we're talking about reproductive health and the importance of having good information in order to make good life decisions in order to stay healthy. One California desert community in the eastern Coachella Valley produces thousands of pounds of dates, grapes, and other produce, thanks to extensive irrigation. But the thousands of farm workers who live in the area are exposed to multiple environmental hazards. They live with the problems. But what they don't have is the data to get the money to make the improvements they need. Lisa Moorhouse reports now on one effort to round up the numbers.
There's a sewage drain that has yellow stuff on it.
Okay.
It's not every day that a group of high school students choose to drive around with a college professor, taking pictures of sewage failure. But that's what Uriel Gutierrez and three of his friends are doing today.
We're looking for areas where there could be a potential problem with black water, contaminated water that could carry diseases and bacteria.
There's another puddle right there, but maybe it's just water.
The professor, Ryan Sinclair of Loma Linda University, explains if a cesspool or septic system overflows, it can contaminate soil with bacteria and pathogens. That's dangerous, he tells them, especially for little kids playing outside.
You want to be separated from your human waste. I think we've been trying to do that for the last 6,000 years or so. So if you see it just out here, just wet dirt from a septic tank that's not working, it's just a bad case of environmental management and needs to be fixed.
Sinclair's the expert in water and sanitation, but the young men, all seniors at Desert Mirage High School, have the most knowledge about this community. Mobile home parks are prevalent here. Many are unpaved, miles from a main sewer line, and have overworked septic systems.
Yeah, I got the app.
Oh, okay, good. So you want to take a picture of it?
Yeah.
Cool.
Mario Beltran's pretty comfortable using his smartphone for documentation.
I'm trying to take a picture about this waste lagoon water that we just found out right now.
The lagoon is too close to where people live, so he takes a picture and uploads it to an app.
And I'm going
to
update it on the app,
which will locate this spot on a map using its GPS coordinates. Professor Sinclair is training these high schoolers in crowdsourcing the data, having a large group of people collecting needed information, which is why they're driving around the valley today.
It looks gooey.
Good or gooey?
The group gooey, empties out of the truck at the edge of a mobile home park, and Gutierrez photographs a puddle.
It looks like corroded on the side, like you know how metal gets rusted? And in the middle, it looks like a nasty cheese and bean put together. Not edible, though.
He's starting to talk like a microbiologist. Oh, yeah.
Sinclair and his public health graduate students planned 5 weeks of training on crowdsourcing and sanitation. The guy said at first they came just to have something to do after school. Gutierrez was intrigued by the technology.
It was the whole app thing that, you know, that brought me in. But now that like I kind of know how to use it, I'm more interested in the topic now.
The teenagers took to the technology, but their parents, not so much. The next afternoon, about 40 people gather at the local Boys and Girls Club, a mix of teenagers, staff from advocacy groups, and parents. To include everyone, Sinclair and his grad students teach the group a process called community mapping. Participants draw maps of their mobile home parks on poster paper, using red pen to mark where they've seen leaky septic tanks or toilets that continually back up. The academics then upload this information, but everyone agrees they'll protect people's privacy when sharing the data. One teenager is using audio equipment to record the meeting and interview participants. Belen Ramirez says she's passionate about the environment.
We're living here. We should take some interest in it.
The high school senior belongs to a club where students make videos, podcasts, and other media about issues important to them. For many, that means the environment. It's personal here, she says, in part because of the prevalence of agriculture.
I mean, I've always lived across from fields, so it's like you see how they go and they spray them. Our parents work in the fields. I guess that's what got me interested in it.
Ramirez is working on a podcast with a message to the EPA and other agency officials who've been coming to the region lately.
You don't need to tell someone that their leg is broken if they see the bone jutting out. We don't need them to come and tell us that our water is bad because there's arsenic in it. We don't need them to tell us that our air is polluted because we know that we live here. So what I want to ask is, why don't they come and show us how to work with those agencies so that together we can come up with solutions to these problems?
Fellow club member Diana Castellanos made a video for an environmental justice conference interviewing fellow students about their biggest concerns.
The environmental issues that I see, like the water really doesn't work to drink, like in my house, we can't drink the water.
So she remembers playing it for locals and for people who live in the resort towns nearby.
Some people from like Palm Springs that were there, they just like gasped. It's kind of interesting how they didn't know and they live right here. It's like their backyard. There was just a whole bunch of gasps and oh, we want to help, and all these people that were just amazed by the video.
Roy Garza teaches video classes at the high school.
And a lot of times in academia and within high school settings, we don't give them a chance to like make it real and relevant.
But he says when students make media and share it online, at conferences, with the community and public agencies, they begin to see themselves differently and walk a little taller.
And part of that comes from that articulation, like understanding what their place in the world is and kind of what hand they've been dealt and what can we realistically do, right, to change stuff.
Diana Castellanos already has her next video planned. Belen Ramirez hopes to major in wildlife conservation when she heads to college in the fall. And those young men crowdsourcing sanitation problems? In April, three of them went to Los Angeles to present their findings to the region's Municipal Water Board. For Latino USA, I'm Lisa Morehouse in the Eastern Coachella Valley.
So much of what we've talked about today on our show has to do with decisions and whether or not people have the ability to make them. We're going to switch gears now for a minute and hear about the decisions that are made in a newsroom. For this week's News or Noise, our regular segment on news literacy, producer Daisy Rosario gives us a peek inside an editorial meeting.
Yes, so this will either be online content, after the new year content.
These are the sounds of an editorial meeting inside the Chicago Tribune building.
So, we've got kind of a wide spectrum that we're planning for.
But this meeting is not for the Trib itself. It's for the MASH, their weekly newspaper and website for teens. Students pitch story ideas. Their fellow journalists pile on, adding their two cents and contributing new angles and details to each potential topic.
I really like having this free-flowing conversation with all these people because it lets you hear other opinions about the same topics and also find people that you agree with and you wouldn't necessarily meet.
Ilani Kaufman is an eager participant in these meetings. She enjoys getting to add things.
As well as it's really interesting to hear what people have to say and you wouldn't have necessarily known about it.
Like Kaufman, Joe Hendricks looks forward to talking to his fellow teen reporters at the meetings. His favorite part is
the just general atmosphere, you know, just how things are and like different people and bringing up different things, things you didn't know, and just basically just getting informed about everything.
Sharing his ideas with the group can still be a bit nerve-wracking for him.
If I have an idea that I think will be interesting, usually I really overanalyze and say, I don't want to be embarrassed. But one of the things I love about here is that they're open to any and all ideas.
They may be teenagers, but what they're doing in this meeting is done in newsrooms around the world. Here at Latino USA, we have lots of editorial meetings. We talk about segments, coverage angles on major topics such as immigration and education. We even make long-term plans for episodes that are months away. Sometimes a specific item will send us off on a tangent. It's the same with the teens.
Well, right now it's The Hobbit versus Harry Potter, and then it's...
Phil Thompson is the editorial director of The MASH. He's used to this.
Well, what's funny about that is, I remember one time somebody brought up, you ever think we have too much Hunger Games coverage or too much Twilight? You can never have too much Hunger Games or too much Twilight when you're a teen publication. You could have something every day and it would still be okay.
Which is fair enough. Those books are popular with adults, too. Though, in the Latino USA conference room, it's usually talk of food that gets us going. Sometimes I'm the one that brings us back when we get off topic. Sometimes it's another producer. At The MASH, the woman who keeps them on topic is managing editor Morgan Olson. She comes to each weekly meeting ready with research on various topics.
So if I notice that the conversation is getting a little bit pop culture heavy, which it usually tends to get, I'll throw out those ideas and just say, hey, like, what do you guys think about this? And just kind of bring it to light.
Olson wants the teens to have a positive experience. And part of that is making it realistic.
It's a matter of taking those topics that we've done articles on and spinning it in a new direction with each individual group of kids, so that we can present our readers with new information, but also give our teen reporters a grasp on, real journalism. Like, how can I take an idea that's been written about by everyone and turn it into something different and new?
The similarities don't end when it comes to making news. They can also be in life. Thompson says the teens often face
some of the same issues that adults face. Life doesn't change just because they're teens. They just have slightly different circumstances. I think the main thing with them is they want a voice. They feel like they're inheriting this world that, we're debating back and forth. And they don't want to be left out of the conversation. These are the issues that they're going to be dealing with in 4 or 5 years. So they want some input.
It's a desire that is often echoed by communities who feel underrepresented by the media. In fact, in a year when many have written about a distinct lack of diversity in newsrooms, The MASH might be ahead of the curve.
We really keep a mind toward diversity. And when I say diversity, we're not just thinking, racially, but we're also talking geographically, different writing levels. We want them to have different personalities, different backgrounds, different experiences. They all bring something special to the table. It creates a better conversation. And I think there's a lot of things adults can learn from listening in on that conversation.
For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
So for all of our regular Latino USA listeners, you know that we end each show with some sabiduría, some words of wisdom to send you off for the week. But for the month of December, we're going to take the time to hear from a group of people who have one shared experience. They've all been deported. Sometime over the next several weeks, the number of deportations since President Obama entered office will hit the 2 million mark. Some deportees have been children. Some have been students. A number of them have simply been people who came here searching for a better life. The deportations have divided families and created a tremendous amount of sadness. But for one young man named Efa Atle, it changed his life in an unexpected way. His story now, in his own words, in a segment we call The Dearly Deported.
My name is Efa Atle. I am 26 years old, and I am from Istanbul, Turkey. I always want to study mechanical engineering. I want to work on cars. And, states for that sound just amazing. It's an amazing country, a lot to see, a lot to experience as a student. Just made sense. On the plane, I was excited. A new country with new people, excited about my life and my future. That's it, I wasn't judging if I made the right decision or not. And from August 2006, I was in West Lafayette, Indiana to study at Purdue. It was just a shock. It was a very small town. It was nothing like I was expecting it to be honest. My life in Istanbul was active, full of friends, full of people, and I just couldn't cope with the life. I was extremely bored. I fell into depression. I was so depressed. I didn't want to leave my house or the apartment. So after a while, I kind of stopped leaving the apartment and I stopped going to classes. It was Thursday morning, 8 a.m. My phone rang. I answered it. It was from immigration. She asked me my name. I answered. She said, "What are you doing in our country?" I said, "I am studying." She said, "No, you're not. What are you doing here?" I didn't know what to say. I was absolutely shocked. She said, "Okay, here's what's going to happen. You're here illegally. You need to leave. I give you until Friday for you to pack up and leave this country. Otherwise, I will come to your house with cops, arrest you, put you into jail, and then deport you, and you can never come back to the States." again, it was Thursday morning that they called, and my deadline was Friday. It was just 1 day. So I called back. I said, okay, I'm going to leave your country. However, I have a lot of stuff that I need to take care of. So she extended my deadline by 1 week. And then by that time, next Friday, I left. They didn't help me at all, but I didn't really ask for any help. And the reason I was getting asked to leave was because I didn't want to be there to start with. It was just that I was waiting for something to happen so my life would be back on track somehow. I didn't really have anything tying me there. It was just a school and the fact that I want to study in the States to get a good education. I think the process helped me grow as a person, so I'm kind of glad for it. After I came back, it was obviously very shocking at first because I never expected to be kicked out or asked to leave from a country. I didn't know what I was doing, to be honest. It's quite interesting, in fact, that when I first went to the States, my aim was to be a mechanical engineer, work with cars. My dream was to work in Formula One with Ferrari if I could. And now I'm going to be a chef, which is quite interesting when you think about this, from engineering to being in the kitchen. And I'm going to get my chef certificate as well as my diploma from college at the same time, pretty much. I am planning to travel the world for about 5 months as a culinary, you know, travel. The States is obviously a very focal point because, you know, the food scene in general is pretty amazing. What chef wouldn't want to be in the States to experience all those talents, all those different types of food? And so probably next year, 2015, January maybe, I'm hoping that I can go to the States.
Efa Atle's story came to us from reporter and Latino USA alum Andres Caballero, who is now based in Turkey. So, do you know someone who's been deported and wants to tell their story? Let us know via Twitter, where we are Latino USA. And, mis queridos, just another reminder, I'll be doing an Ask Me Anything on Reddit.com Monday, December 9th at 3 p.m. Eastern. I can't wait to chat with you, so I'll see you there. And for this week, that's our program. Produced by Carolina Gonzalez, AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Daisy Rosario, Brenda Salinas, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Jonathan Wolf and Eva DeLapp. Special thanks to Caitlin Prest, Mitra Kaboli, and the crew at the Audio Smut podcast, who produced this week's story on sterilization. It's a great show. Be sure to check it out at audiosmut.ca. And thanks to Sarah Liu and WBEZ in Chicago. Additional engineering this week by Brendan Baker and Stephanie LeBeau. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And don't forget to join us on Reddit Monday at 3 p.m.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians.
He's starting to talk like a microbiologist.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators. Hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring with the Floor Finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org. And Newman's Own Foundation, giving all profits from Newman's Own to charity and pursuing the common good for over 30 years. This is NPR.